Bloomberg Audio Studios. Podcasts, radio, news. You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
Hope you had a great weekend and welcome indeed to the Monday edition and more specifically the early edition of Balance of Power here on Bloomberg Radio, Satellite Radio Channel 121, Bloomberg Originals and YouTube. Search Bloomberg Business News Live to find us on YouTube. We keep the stream up all day for our programming from Washington to New York and back again with the president not wasting time in making some news today. And I'll let you know, lawmakers are coming back to town. There's going to be a lot of talk about sanctions on Capitol Hill as well as rescissions. And we'll get to all of that in a moment with Laura Davison. Today it's about Ukraine. And the president told you this was coming, right? We sat here Friday knowing that the president was planning a major announcement, as it was termed, on Monday. There were great questions about this, what this might include and whether it would be offensive weapons. The answer is kind of yes. The news here really is more not just American weapons reaching Ukraine, but the fact that NATO is going to pay for them. This answers the question we were asking about whether there'd be a major emergency supplemental request coming from this administration, something we couldn't imagine, right? The idea of spending more money on Ukraine would go against the grain for this president. But he's clearly upset with Vladimir Putin, and he's found a new way to get American weapons in the hands of Volodymyr Zelensky. Here's Donald Trump from the Oval Office a short time ago, sitting next to the NATO Secretary General, Mark Rutte.
But we're very, very unhappy with him, and we're going to be doing very severe tariffs if we don't have a deal in 50 days, tariffs at about 100%. I'm disappointed in President Putin because I thought we would have had a deal 2 months ago, but it doesn't seem to get there. So based on that, we're going to be doing secondary tariffs if we don't have a deal in 50 days. It's very simple. And they'll be at 100%. And that's the way it is.
Is there more gold in there than there was on Friday? Are you seeing this on YouTube? The gilding never stops in the Trump White House. That was that big gold eagle there on Friday? Laura Davison is our deputy bureau chief here at Bloomberg in Washington, D.C., and is, of course, helping to man all of our coverage here from the White House to the Capitol and back, and she's with us right now. Great to see you. They're adding to the gold as we go here, are they not?
There was a certain glow in that clip in particular.
My God, that was like Liberace's office. He did, by the way, mention the Resolute desk, which I guess has been cleaned up and returned. I've been waiting for the update on this. Remember when Elon Musk's son, X, he drooled or something on the, they brought the desk out of the Oval. They were going to have it refinished, and I never heard that it came back.
And this is clear, you know, even at the cabinet meeting on Friday, Trump was talking about the decor. He's been spending a certain amount of time
really into
picking picking different frames, picking different clocks, including stealing some, apparently, from the State Department, from Marco Rubio.
This is, of course, not why you're here. We're talking about Ukraine, and this is really interesting watching the evolution here when it comes to Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, and this war, because it was just weeks ago he was talking about his great relationship with Putin. It was weeks before that he was yelling at Volodymyr Zelensky in the Oval, and it was weeks before that he predicted that he could finish this war on day one. What does he think at this point?
This is a total reversal. And even go back, you know, even further, a year ago, he was talking about abandoning NATO partners. That really caused a stir on the campaign trail. Now you have a meeting in the Oval, a very cordial meeting with the Secretary General of NATO. He even mentioned that he's really become very friendly with this organization,
yeah,
especially at the NATO meeting a couple weeks ago. You know, part of this is that Mark Rutte has been very strategic in how he's courted this relationship with Donald Trump, and he's arranged this deal that Trump very much likes, that the U.S. won't be giving weapons, that they're going to be purchased through NATO and then given to Ukraine. This is very much the way he has always wanted to structure these deals going back to day one of his term. If he didn't want some sort of aid, he wanted some sort of financial deal. Remember, there was the rare earths deal that he was trying to cut. And this is, very much kind of where he sees kind of the role he wants to play of making these financial deals, these business deals, versus sort of a diplomatic solution.
It's like the military version of we're going to build a wall and have Mexico pay for it, right? He gets to do something that is maybe controversial giving weapons to Ukraine, at least with his own base, but as long as we're not paying for it, we somehow don't have our fingerprints on it. Is that the idea?
Yes, and it also makes it an easier sell for Trump because he doesn't have to go to Congress and get them to approve additional money. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not clear if Congress is going to approve this Russia sanctions package that has been debated for several weeks. You know, these various versions of this bill have, you know, sanctions of 500%.
Right.
Those are massive. You know, Lindsey Graham has been talking about scaling that back. Mm-hmm. But the bill right now has pretty significant support, and it's possible, as Trump mentioned in the Oval Office earlier, that it could pass, you know, in the coming weeks.
Even with the help of Democrats. It's interesting. I'm glad you mentioned that. In that that sound cut we just heard of the president, he's talking about tariffs. He's 100% tariffs. He means sanctions. That's what this bill is.
Yes, this is, and Trump seems to really be talking about two things. One, perhaps some sanctions that he would impose unilaterally in addition to whatever Congress decides to do. So he's talking about these 100% secondary tariffs, which we understand to be sanctions.
Yeah.
These would be essentially levies on trading partners that buy Russian goods, so especially Russian oil. So this would be hitting other countries, essentially trying to further isolate Russia and further dampen any demand for their goods.
We've got a great conversation coming up a little bit later in the hour with Max Bergman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who's looking at what the effect would be here. And if you're a country like India, that could be a real problem if that's passed, right?
Yes, especially if it's, you know, 100% or even, you know, forget 500%.
Right.
Those are, you know, tariff levels that just completely cut off, or sanction levels that cut off trade entirely.
So we're speaking about tariffs, and the president actually made news about tariffs over the weekend. He was asked about this, and I'm not sure it's even top of mind with the Ukraine stuff here, but he threatened another 30% on Mexico, USMCA excluded. We spoke to Peter Navarro here on Friday talking about Canada, 35%. That also is USMCA goods excluded. So these aren't terribly meaningful at the moment, are they? Doesn't that cover the vast amount of imports from both countries?
That really does. So it really lessens the scope there. And of course, you know, Canada and Mexico are the U.S.'s largest trading partners. Mm-hmm. Though not far down the line is the EU, which has a 30% tariff rate, much to the surprise.
So that's the real news this weekend, right? Keep going.
And that really came as a surprise because the U.S. has been in talks with the EU for weeks, if not months, about cutting a deal. The EU leaders at one point thought they were going to be able to keep that tariff level at 10%. Which, while, you know, wasn't their preferred outcome, would be a level that could support much of the trade that is ongoing. But at 30%, you have a lot of companies in the EU saying, look, this just doesn't, the math of these trade deals don't make sense anymore, and we're going to have to suddenly find other countries to export our goods.
Wow. The idea not to retaliate is pretty interesting here as well. Is this don't poke the bear or just give us time to cut deals with other countries?
I think the next 3 weeks will really be a key sign here. You know, do they get to August 1?
Yes.
And are they able to either, you know, stave off that implementation, push it back a couple weeks, get a lower deal? Or, you know, is it August 1 and suddenly 30%? That's when you could really see countries start banding together, putting on some of these retaliatory tariffs and sort of daring Trump to, you know, back down.
Your calendar must look like a riot. So we've got, what is it now? August 1 is the next deadline for reciprocal tariffs. We just dropped a 50-day waiting period on Russia sanctions, he said. I don't know why 50. We seem to be in two-week increments. And didn't we already have something else we were waiting 2 weeks on here? What else is... What's the other deadline on your calendar right now?
We've got a lot of different things percolating between all the copper tariffs and all these sectoral tariffs.
Those are all
due at various points in the fall. One nice thing about that 50-day deadline for the Ukraine tariffs, that gets us past Labor Day. So people can enjoy their Labor Day vacations and then come back to Washington and deal with the next turn of the screw.
So, all right, I waited till the end to ask you this. I don't want to put you in an awkward situation, but I have to ask you about this Jeffrey Epstein story. The president talked about it last week. He called out the reporter for asking about it. You've got the deputy director of the FBI not showing up for work now, calling out the attorney general. Is this real, this MAGA split? Does it spill over into anything policy related that a Bloomberg audience should care about, or is this a tabloid story?
This certainly could mean, shakeups at the FBI and the Justice Department at the highest levels if, you know, some of what we're seeing comes to fruition. And this is really sort of a cautionary tale of when you make promises, when you are not in government, to then you are suddenly in control of things, you control all the levers of power. If you get your side really amped up that something's happening, you have to be able to then, show something on the back end. So this is really sort of the insider-outsider dichotomy. Of, you know, all these people from the outside were railing against government are now in key positions and you have to deliver.
There's a lot of tape on Cash Patel, Bongino, J.D. Vance talking about this list and how they're going to expose it. and those things don't go away automatically. I'll be very curious to see how they manage to do this. CC, I think you might be onto something there. Laura, it's great to have you back. Laura Davison helps to run our coverage here in Washington, our deputy bureau chief at Bloomberg, and always great to spend some time when we can pull her away from the desk. Producer James is back today. Did I tell you that? America's producer is back with us. And we'll have much more straight ahead as we consider the impact of these Russia sanctions if they were in fact implemented. Not just sanctions, but secondary sanctions that could ricochet around the world. Our conversation ahead with Max Bergman at CSIS coming up on Bloomberg.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
With big thanks to Cece Charandoff, Justin Miller, and Elizabeth Sedrin for helping us out last week while producer James was off golfing. He's back with us today here in the nation's capital, and we were raring to go with news coming from the White House. We started early today, Secretary General at NATO in the Oval Office. President Trump talking about Ukraine as promised. This is going to carry us largely through the day here in the news flow. As lawmakers in the Senate, Lindsey Graham and John Thune, for that matter, craft a sanctions package against Russia, the president's tapping the brakes on this. He says 50 days. Give Vladimir Putin 50 days to cut a deal, and then we'll talk about sanctions. That, of course, has been on the table for weeks now. The president even altering the language in that sanctions legislation before it ever sees the light of day. But it looks like the news today is about weapons specifically. That's why the NATO boss was in the Oval Office, Mark Rutte, sitting next to Donald Trump as he announced this plan, something we touched on last week. If you listen to this program, you might have seen this coming. A deal in which American weapons get to Ukraine, but we don't go to Capitol Hill and spend a bunch of money to do it. They'll be bought by NATO from the U.S., from U.S. contractors. In some cases, European countries will send their own weapons and we'll backfill them. But in the end, our NATO allies will pay for this. Here's Donald Trump speaking earlier about the Patriot missile batteries that are on the way to Ukraine.
It's everything. It's Patriots. It's all of them. It's a full complement with the batteries.
And when do you expect them to arrive in Ukraine, sir?
Well, we're going to have some come very soon, within days, actually. Because a couple of the countries that have Patriots are going to swap over and will replace the Patriots with the ones they have. And Matt will coordinate with NATO. But so it's going to be, they're going to start arriving very soon.
This was just last hour at the White House as we bring the voice of Max Bergman to this story, who is director of the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at CSIS, the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Max, it's great to have you, and I'm curious to hear more about your research into the impact of sanctions and secondary sanctions on Russia and other countries around the world. I wonder your thoughts initially, though, on this deal to continue providing weapons without going back to Congress with an ask. Is this a smart angle for the White House to get NATO involved financially, as we heard today?
Well, I think it's good news, especially for Ukraine. I think we should be clear about what the baseline here was. You know, the administration a week or so ago announced that it was going to suspend deliveries of Patriot missile systems to Ukraine. Now, these are vital to protecting Ukrainian civilians. And right now, it just looks like the White House is sort of turning that back on, and that future deliveries then are going to be paid for by the Europeans. But really, a lot of this money had already been paid for by the Biden administration. What we're looking at are just sort of the deliveries of future systems. But I think what it does represent is kind of a real shift in the burden of supporting Ukraine from the United States to Europe, where the Europeans effectively pay us to provide weapons that we were previously providing. At the very least, it is a good thing for Ukraine. Someone is going to pay for this. It looks like Europe, and that the supply of very precious Patriot missile systems will continue to flow to Ukraine, which is really vital for their security.
I'm glad you mentioned these Patriot missile systems. You used the word precious. How many of these do we have? Because when weapons to Ukraine were halted by the defense secretary and another official in the Pentagon a couple of weeks ago, that was the justification that we've run out of stuff like this.
Yeah, and part of it is connected to events in the Middle East where the U.S. has used a lot of Patriot missiles, interceptors, to shoot down Iranian drones and other missiles. And every winter, it has been a big test for the United States about whether it could supply Ukraine with enough air defense to get through, because Russia started targeting Ukrainian power plants and other facilities. And there are some reports that the U.S. is really low in stockpiles, perhaps down well below 50%. And this is a big problem, and it's a big problem for our defense industrial sector that really can't produce enough. And there's just been big orders by the U.S. Army to try to ramp up production of these missile interceptors used by the Patriot system. So this is a problem. It has been a problem throughout this war, that not only does Ukraine need a lot, but that our defense industrial base and Europe's defense industrial base can't really meet the mark in terms of production.
Really makes you wonder, Max, how many years we are going to have this conversation for. It's just endless. And everyone seems to know that it's something that's badly needed, yet we never get down to actually increasing the capacity of the DIB, as they call it. I know that your expertise, though, is in the sanctions package that we're talking about. Your economic acumen here and the research that you've done is something that I'd like to ask you about, because sanctions are one thing. And that's another bit. Secondary sanctions, something else we talk about a lot, but we never quite get to. This was on the table for the balance of the Biden administration, but we're looking at some pretty hefty numbers here, whether it's 100% or 500%, Max. What would this mean for the likes of India or other countries doing business with Russia?
Well, it could be really significant. And, you know, the president is going about secondary sanctions in sort of a different way, by using tariffs as opposed to sanctioning the companies or countries that are then are acting as workarounds for the main sanctions target. What's happened for Russia is that the Russian oil sector has been diverted to India and China in particular. And the United States has been very reticent in particular to sanction India. We are trying to develop close ties with India. We see India as a strong potential partner vis-a-vis China. And we've also been reticent in some ways to go after a number of Chinese banks and other Chinese entities. So I think, you know, with this tariff play, we'll see. It could have real ramifications, I think, for Russia's oil sector. But it would also have real implications for the United States bilateral relations. And the thing we have to remember is part of what the Biden administration was trying to do was to keep Russian oil on the global market. We wanted Russia to take a haircut in terms of how much profit it was getting in terms of sales. But we didn't really have a problem with Russia selling oil. We just wanted to sell it at a haircut because we wanted Russian oil on the market to keep global prices low. The Trump administration, I think, is taking a bit more of a blunt approach. And so we'll see if this begins to really lead to a spike in oil prices.
What would this mean for China as well, Max?
Well, I think what we've seen is that China has means of retaliating. So it could lead to an escalation of the U.S.-China trade war, which has sort of already been rekindled. China has demonstrated its willingness to use rare earths and other things to hit back at the United States. So, you know, China does recognize that its oil dependence, its dependence on Russia as well as the Middle East, represents a real strategic vulnerability. It's part of the reason why they are going whole hog into renewables and clean technology. But for China, I think this could be really significant if the U.S. does impose this. And I think we would see China try to retaliate against us. So I don't think it would just be we set these, China stops buying Russian oil and moves on. I think it would try to find other ways of responding.
Well, so I guess what comes out the other end of the pipe here, if this is in place for some time, Max, are we on the phone with OPEC about how this is going to work and what would it mean for crude oil prices?
Yeah, I think there's some real potential that we get on the phone with the Saudis and others in the Gulf states and say, hey, we want you to offset some of the shock that this could cause. We want you to open up the taps, put more oil on the market. We shall see if they do that. The Biden administration, I think, didn't feel that it had the political relationship to actually do that. And the Saudis, I don't think, were willing to. But with Trump, maybe it's different. I think the bigger, broader question here, though, is that Trump has not shown a lot of interest in trying to really stick it to the Russians, economically or militarily. He has not demonstrated in the past a lot of support for Ukraine. If that is shifting, the question is, how far does that shift? I think what we've seen is a partial shift The U.S. is now looks like it's going to continue military supplies, but there's no indication Trump is going to go to Congress, try to ramp up our production for Ukraine. And then the economic question is, how much of an economic hit is the president willing to absorb to stick it to the Russians in support of Ukraine? There's limits to what the Biden administration would do. So I do have some doubts about how far we are willing to go. And I think Russia may just try to call our bluff here. And it'll be really interesting when the 50 or 60 days expire, whether that prompts sort of a strong U.S. reaction. But there could be a good outcome if we just simply get India to lower lower the amount it's buying. And maybe there's some way to negotiate something with the Indians to reduce the amount of Russian oil and other Russian military goods and things that it's purchasing.
That'd be very Trumpy, wouldn't it? You put 500% tariffs on the line or sanctions on the line. And in the meantime, you just crank back India a little bit to try to increase the pain, knowing that those sanctions were never going to take effect. Max, what happens over the next 50 days?
Well, I think what happens over the next 50 days is Russia keeps pummeling Ukraine. What I think we're seeing with the statement on especially the arms deliveries is simply the preservation of the status quo in terms of the West is going to keep supporting Ukraine and supplying Ukraine with supplies. Now, that's not quite enough, and Russia thinks it can win this war now and is going on another military offensive and has been going on a military offensive because it sees a light at the end of the tunnel of the U.S. sort of drawing back support. Now, what I hope happens over the next 50 days is that there's a ramp up on European efforts to support Ukraine militarily. I think that's happening. But then also that the U.S. begins to negotiate with India and perhaps even with China to reduce oil flows from Russia into India. And that maybe there's talks with the Saudis about offsetting any cuts to Russian supplies on the global market. I would hope to see that. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure we're going to see all of that, but I think we may see some progress perhaps with India. That's at least my hope.
There you have it. Remember this conversation in 50 days when this comes around. Max, it's great to see you. Thank you for the insights today. Max Bergman, CSIS. He's director of the Europe, Russia, and Eurasia program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Just a stable of smart people at CSIS who we tap on a regular basis here. Clarifying the remarks on tariffs versus sanctions here, Howard Lutnick, the Commerce Secretary, saying that it's economic sanctions. You can also make an economic penalty. If I catch you doing it, then you have to pay. You can do tariffs, you can do sanctions. Those are both tools in the toolbox. So I guess those are interchangeable now. You learn something every day on this program.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Balance of Power podcast. Catch us live weekdays at noon and 5 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
And we want to get more on these weapon systems that are going to be heading Ukraine's way, whatever the route is. Of course, this route through NATO, and turn to retired Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery, who's joining us now here on Bloomberg TV and radio. He's a former destroyer squadron commander, now senior fellow at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Admiral, thank you for being here on Balance of Power. When we consider these Patriot missile systems themselves, the idea that the U.S. will be backfilling countries that send these systems to Ukraine, how quickly can we actually do so? What kind of capacity exists in this regard right now?
Well, thanks for having me. You know, this is the real challenge. The president's language was a little nonspecific, as was Rutte's, and conflicting. But I will tell you, we can get them there quickly through either of the two routes that were mentioned. The one route of the Europeans transfer their PAC-2, that's a lower level type of Patriot missile, to the Ukrainians, which the Ukrainians could use very easily, and then order them from the United States to refill the European armory, or the United States could transfer them and then NATO pays, the European countries pay the United States for the United States to replenish itself. Either of those methods gets them there much quicker than a Ukrainian order from the United, you know, from a defense industrial based country, which would be years. Either of these cases, he says, could be weeks to months to have missiles and batteries transferring to Ukraine.
Admiral, we're really glad to have you with us today, because before you were on the USS Nimitz, the USS McCampbell, the USS Elliott, the USS Bainbridge, and I can keep going, the Teddy Roosevelt, you were on the National Security Council at the White House, late 90s. And when we look back a couple of years here, How do we rationalize the fact that we've been having this conversation about our defense industrial base for decades, and we really don't have a greater capacity to show for it? Was this not something that you were talking about that many years ago inside the White House?
No, you're exactly right. I think we've got about a 20-year deficit, particularly in our munitions, and that's what we're talking about here, whether it's Patriot missiles here, the Standard missiles the Navy was using to shoot down Houthi rebel cruise missiles, or the offensive weapons that we were using against the Houthis or have used in other locales. We were running at about 25% of the proper level of munitions order. In other words, when we needed four, we ordered one. When you do that over 20 years, you really create a deficit. And worse, you tell the defense industrial base companies, I'm not going to do major orders. And they reduce their ability to produce. So what you've seen over the last 3 years are pretty consistent from the supplemental, the Ukraine supplemental, Taiwan supplemental a couple of years ago, this year's budget and next year's budget. Actual investments in the defense industrial base, where the United States is contributing to defense industrial base companies like Lockheed and Raytheon and Northrop Grumman to expand their ability, their capacity to produce. They obviously contribute. And so we are beginning to grow our capacity. But this is a 20-year deficit. The only deficit that's worse is the European one, which almost went to zero.
Well, and now, of course, Europeans are trying to step up in their own defense spending category, which is one of the main aims of this administration. And that was a point emphasized by Secretary General Rutte in the Oval Office with the president earlier. As we consider the kind of allied capacity, if you will, I also would like to ask you, Admiral, about Russia's capacity and specifically the supply of weapons that Russia is still getting from countries like North Korea. How should we be considering Russia's ability to continue to replenish its own stocks, continue striking Ukraine, often civilian targets, and how it's matched against the assistance Ukraine is now getting in terms of air defenses?
Well, that's a great question, Kelly, because you're exactly right. Ukraine is fighting four countries: Russia, North Korea, Iran, and China. And in fact, Russia today is firing more artillery from North Korea than their own. In other words, the majority of the artillery being used by Russia is North Korean. North Korea gave about 6 million rounds, which is 20 years of U.S. production, to the Russians. Iran has built a Shahed drone factory in Russia. After giving them thousands of their own Shahed drones or selling them, they now have a factory they're producing at. That's what's hammering the Ukrainian cities every night. And the third thing is China has been backstopping the economy with increases in imports and exports, but equally importantly, providing the microelectronics that are used in Russian cruise and ballistic missiles. So all three of these countries, as axis of authoritarians, are supporting the fourth, Russia, in this fight. And that's who Ukraine's been going against. So that's probably why it's appropriate for the United States and Europe to assist with at least with equipment, but not forces.
It's incredible to consider four countries. You know, Bloomberg interviewed the head of Ukrainian military intelligence, Admiral, who said North Korea is now supplying as much as 40% of Russia's ammunition in this war. You mentioned the shells that were having trouble manufacturing as quickly, but they're prepared at least to send a lot of other stuff. Ballistic missiles, artillery systems. Russia, of course, providing money and technology to North Korea in return. What's the weapon system you're most worried about? And could we see them include nukes coming from Pyongyang?
So, certainly I not nukes, because, not that Russia would use them, but they have their own tactical nukes already. But I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's something we should always be sensitive to. But the North Korean thing, that the North Korean weapons that bother me the most are, in fact, the artillery rounds. You're exactly right. But what bothers me even more than those are those Shahed drones. Shahed drones from Iran and the factory that was built in Russia are really putting pressure on the Ukrainian air defense system. And they're causing civilian casualties and damage to critical infrastructure, energy, water, the financial systems of Ukraine are hit every night. And so to me, that Iranian drone and that North Korean artillery are really making a difference in hurting the Ukrainians.
Well, and as you point to the targets that Russia is taking aim at in Ukraine, obviously part of the objective here, Admiral, is to wear on Ukrainian morale. Do you sense that we reach a point where that is effective, where Ukraine's kind of desire to keep prosecuting or defending itself in this war is going to diminish? Is Russia being effective in that regard?
So I don't think so. And here's why I say that. I go to Ukraine every quarter for a couple of weeks to do training with their military and their general staff. And I am convinced the Ukrainians won't lose. That doesn't mean they can push Russia out. It doesn't mean they can recapture Crimea, but they won't lose. They're losing incrementally a kilometer here, a kilometer there of land, but they have the societal resilience to stay in this fight and win. They just need access to weapons. And that's what President Trump gave them today. He gave them access to weapon systems that they need. The one thing I wish he had gone one step further and given them access to some of our offensive weapons again, the ATACMS, mm-hmm. long range artillery. Mm-hmm. That would have been great because then they could break up Russian formations when they're coming together in Russia, by waiting till they're very close to the Ukrainian lines.
Yeah.
We want to stay in touch with you, Admiral. Let us know when you're going back to Ukraine. Retired Rear Admiral Mark Montgomery, Senior Fellow, the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. We thank you for the insights, only here on Bloomberg.
Thanks for listening to the Balance of Power podcast. Make sure to subscribe if you haven't already at Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can find us live every weekday from Washington, D.C. at noontime Eastern at Bloomberg.com.